I, Warlock, The Warlock Wars, Book 1, written by M. A. McNeice. Copyright Mademark Publishing. Narration provided by Wondervox. Love is Eternal. Part 1, One of a Kind. Chapter 1. Grief is not linear. It's one of the most important things I've learned in my very long existence, taught to me by a grief counselor I saw for several months during the darkest time of my life. It doesn't have a beginning, middle, and end. Jacqueline Ward, the counselor, told the small group of us that we would mourn for many years to come, in many ways. This was especially numbing to hear, considering how long I could expect to live. She said it is more like a wave, receding for a time, then swelling, and sometimes crashing down on us in those terrible moments when the loss of someone becomes acute, and we struggle to accept that we will never see them again. For me, it was compounded by knowing this was true for everyone I've loved. Outliving them all only turned the losses from severe to chronic, a dull, ever-present ache I feel even now. Other people think grief is some kind of station stop on a train we ride, and once a certain amount of time has passed, we are expected to move on. They lose patience with us, as if our duty is not to remember the loved ones we've lost, but to help them forget, to make them less uncomfortable in our presence. It's not something I have ever been good at or wanted to comply with. Other people's reactions to my sorrow are not my problem. They can go on and live their grief-free lives. They just can't expect sympathy from me when it happens to them, and it will. To live is to know loss. To live long is to know an emptiness in the soul that had once been filled by people. It's the price of being human, even if, like me, you're only part human. For me, it's the part that grieves, and the part that was determined to have my revenge. Living forever was never in the job description. In fact, I'd place it last on my list of demands if I ever had to interview for a position as a warlock. Luckily, I didn't have any competition at the time of my ascension. There's nothing else to call it. I wasn't elected. I didn't rise through the ranks. I was born a warlock, and when I came of age at 13, I was burdened with a future I had not asked for or wanted. Becoming what I am is not something I aspired to. It just happened. One day I was little Julius Tide, prepubescent annoyance to the adults in my life, and the next day I was a prince among witches. I took none of it for granted, mind you. And had it not been for an upbringing by a half dozen members of a coven that included my mother and two aunts, I would not have been prepared in any way for what was expected of me. I never considered myself above the witches in my life. I wasn't in it for power or prestige. In many ways, I was a sort of accidental warlock, born and bred into it with the kind of luck of the draw that has always benefited wealthy people and royalty. I came into being having drawn the long stick, so to speak. My mother, Audrey Tide, maiden name Daly, was a strong-willed woman in every respect, including marrying a man her family disapproved of and whose only impressive features were his name and his destiny as a half-vampire. Augustus Tide came from a line of men who preferred pretentious names and bad habits. His single bit of good fortune in life, if you consider it that, was having his assault by a down-on-her-luck vampire interrupted by a group of hoodlums who mistook her for easy prey. I hadn't been born yet. That would come 2 years later. But ridiculously named Augustus had been drinking in an unfamiliar bar in an unfamiliar Vermont town, and he'd been set upon by a woman posing as a prostitute. Daddy was known for his casual infidelities, so I was later told, and his readiness to employ a sex worker of any class was not what shocked the senses, but what happened next. To his near-fatal surprise, it was his neck she wanted. Nothing in the lower extremities, and had the thugs not followed her there expecting some quick change and a little harmless robbery, he would have been drained and left for undead. According to the story he told 1,000 times, and which my mother ignored just as often, the vampire defended herself quite heroically, dispatching the 3, or 4, or 6, depending on his telling, thieves before being shot by the bartender. Apparently, the saloon owner was fine with my father being murdered, for all intents and purposes, in a dark back booth, but not with the attention the slaughter she'd accomplished would bring to his fine establishment. He pumped her full of shot from a sawed-off. She was unhappy about it, and while she took her displeasure out on the man who'd served his last drink, my father managed to escape out a back door, wounded but not feasted upon enough to make it more than a lifelong ailment. He was only half vampire, a condition that would make him a misfit the rest of his days, and that would give his offspring the gift of excruciatingly long lives. My mother is dead. My father is buried. My sister lives in secrecy. I am a warlock. Chapter 2. Charlotte and I moved to New York City in 1962. I've been told that someone with my condition, vampire-blooded and warlock-raised, can expect to live 2 centuries at least. That makes me middle-aged in normal human years, give or take a decade. But I'm not normal. Had I been, you would not be hearing this story, and I would not be telling it. The length of years someone like me lives has a way of distorting everything, creating a strange and unfamiliar center. Halfway to dead for someone like me is long buried for almost everyone else. Almost. That's the key, the central axis around which everything else turns. For I am not alone. There are others like me, some of them distinctly not like me. There are vampires, witches and warlocks, sorcerers, and so it's rumored, an occasional werewolf. I've encountered quite a few of them, and wish I'd never met one in particular, but it became my mission to meet him again, and to put an end to him. Once I'd accomplished that seemingly insurmountable feat, if in fact it could be done, I would gladly die. It could be a moment after I'd finished him, or 20 years later. With him dead, I would welcome my own passing from this vale of tears. New York is not a place I ever intended to live. I'd grown up in a small Vermont town that will remain nameless to protect the guilty. Some of my mother's kind still thrive there, and I'd rather not add them to the list of the hunted. It's been a long list for centuries, its victims ranging from the truly deserving to the undeniably innocent. I'm not sure where the coven we belong to falls in that continuum, but Corinne still lives in the area and has managed to avoid detection all these years. Why ruin it for her? Charlotte was the one who wanted to move to the city. And not just any city. The one so famous that it's simply called the city by everyone who lives within 100 miles of its magnificent skyline. I will grant it that, despite the misgivings I've always had about the place. She'd marveled at stories about it in magazines, and cooed over images on the old black and white Zenith television her family had in their living room. "We must go there," she'd said one morning, after returning from lunch in town with my mother and sister. Charlotte knew them as a widow and her daughter, not as women steeped in the arts, black, white, or otherwise. "Someday," I'd replied. "When, Julius? Let's make plans now. A trip to New York would be so marvelous, don't you think?" I knew she'd wanted to get away, to go anywhere else, after the events of the previous months. She had wanted to flee, to outrun them, as it were, without ever saying this was her motive. I had no way of knowing the price we would pay for our escape. I considered making excuses not to go, only to surrender within minutes. I booked tickets on a train for the following weekend, and our destinies were sealed. You can see Manhattan from far off, and as you approach it, the sight can take your breath away. Its skyscrapers grow with each passing mile, simultaneously imposing and inviting. To the unjaded mind, it appears as the Emerald City must have appeared to Dorothy and her ragtag band of misfits, as a shimmering, promising destination where adventure awaits. That it is instead a final resting place of broken dreams and anonymous tragedies is lost only on those who have spent no real time in the shadows of its monoliths. I have been here for many years, much of them preparing for war and surviving skirmishes, taking casualties when they were unavoidable. I know the truth of the city. Each promise a peril, each invitation a trap. But for a brief moment in time, Charlotte was delighted, and her happiness lulled me into thinking it would last forever. I stayed for revenge. I stayed as a spider stays in a corner of its web, waiting to pounce on a particular prey. Did he know where I was? Given his stealth and his genius for avoiding capture, I'd say he was aware of me from the moment we stepped off the train. He of no name I'm willing to speak for now. It so fouls my mouth. But the time was coming. I had to believe that, the way the foolish believe in heaven, when I would form his name into a word, and I would spit it out with such ferocity that the world would quake. It was my mission, my raison d'être. It was what I lived for, and what if it came to that I would die for. Chapter 3. I met Charlotte Blythe in the spring of that year. I'd celebrated my birthday quietly with my mother and sister the previous Sunday. Corinne and I knew our lives would be unnaturally long, something we preferred not to bring attention to by marking the years. Mother had insisted on observing these annual reminders, so we'd had cake with homemade ice cream. Corinne had given me a light blue cotton shirt for the coming summer, and Mother had stitched a new quilt for my bed. Back then, we were enjoying our lives in our little witches' enclave in Vermont. Being witches, and in my case a warlock, is not a moneymaker. We had to have the trappings of a normal life, which meant homes that looked like the ones nearby where normal people lived, children attending school with the less, shall we say, gifted, and work to provide income as well as the appearances we needed to maintain this facade. Contrary to misinformation, wild imaginations, and television shows, witches do not make things appear from thin air, including your standard American currency. Bills had to be paid, food had to be bought. So my mother and aunts worked at looms creating blankets, bedspreads, and various wall hangings, as well as quilts with a deliberately countrified flair, and sold them to tourists marveling at our quaint rural lifestyle. Apparently, they mistook us for Amish. I spent my days overseeing the modest farm my father had somehow managed to sustain. We had crops, which I did not tend, and animals, which I paid farmhands to raise. Between the sale of beef, pork, chicken, and corn, we lived frugally but comfortably. And being seen as a farmer rather than a warlock by the surrounding community served me very well. It also gave us the privacy the coven needed, for a barn doubles quite nicely as a sanctuary. My father was dead by then, a fact none of us mourned, given the man's fondness for self-pity and cheap whiskey. He never let us forget his encounter with the wretched vampire, as if we could, considering what his newly tainted bloodline did to me and my sister, and it made him an unpleasant man to be around. When he was hit head-on driving down the road one day by a passing bread delivery truck, an empty bottle of liquor on the seat beside him, we grieved for the appropriate amount of time and acted as if carrying on without him would be difficult, but manageable. My mother had been prescient enough to have a life insurance policy on Daddy, so we did not find ourselves in an all-too-typical panic about how to make ends meet without him. We did just fine. While I had two uncles, each married to one of my aunts, I was effectively the only male for witching purposes. Uncle Frederick and Uncle Jason knew their wives were in the coven, but neither man had much interest in the quasi-religion the women practiced. They could be seen at gatherings serving only ceremonial purposes, holding a chalice, or lighting candles. I always had the sense they experienced a certain distaste for it all, which could explain why Uncle Jason told me once he was an atheist. While he couldn't abide Christianity, he found even less to devote himself to in witchcraft. He loved my Aunt Claire fiercely, and that was why he participated in her religious rituals, observations, and occasional spell casting. But he was not a true believer. Uncle Frederick always seemed a little resentful, though he hid it. His wife, my Aunt Lillian, had a strong personality both inside and outside of the coven. People knew who Lillian Chasten was, even if only a select few knew she was a high-ranking member of a coven. She had a way of overshadowing other people, especially Frederick, and he kept it all pushed down inside him until one day he was simply gone. To this day, no one knows if he left or if he was disposed of somehow. I like to think he escaped what must have been an oppressive marriage, but given my aunt's sometimes frightening darkness, anything is possible. Charlotte walked into my life one Saturday afternoon. We'd been at the local farmer's market that also served as an arts and crafts fair once a month. The blankets and rugs my mother and her sisters made sold very well, and we usually brought in enough money in one afternoon to substantially supplement our income for the month. I was packing up the few things that had not sold, looking forward to getting home as dusk arrived. The days were still short, and we all preferred to be in familiar surroundings, the safety of a house we knew well, when nightfall came. For one thing, we knew the vampire who had poisoned my father was not an especially unique creature, and they had a way of knowing where to find a local witch, considered a delicacy among their kind. For another thing, my sister and I were getting older, and the real possibility that our evenings together on the farm might not last much longer weighed on us all. My aunts had their own homes, of course, but we always spent the night after the fair together, often until the sun began clawing its way back into the sky. It was a ritual we cherished. "Am I too late?" a woman's voice asked. "I'm one of those people who really should not work in retail or anything customer-facing. I'm not a people person." I was irritated by the question, even though I didn't know yet who'd asked it. My impulse was to turn around and snap, "Yes, you're too late. We have homes to go to." But I'd been chastised by my mother for having what some customers considered an unfriendly attitude. So instead, I took a quick, deep breath and turned to face the questioner. Customers may not always be right, but they are always the ones with the money. "Of course not," I said, as I spun slowly around and found myself almost gasping at her beauty. "My cousin bought one of your mother's afghans and I absolutely love it. I assume it was your mother, though perhaps I assume wrongly." "You are correct," I said, unable at the moment to think of any other words. Language, and the ability to speak it, had fled me. With barely a few feet separating us, I was face to face with the most stunning woman I had ever seen. Everything else we said that afternoon, up to and including "thank you" for her purchase, as I gave her change with a trembling hand, is lost to me. It's as if I said nothing more at all, consumed by the effort it took not to stare at her. Charlotte Blythe was 23 years old at the time. Had she lived to be 100, she would have remained as beautiful. Her hair was a buttery blonde, tumbling in waves over her shoulders. Her skin was so perfect it seemed manufactured from another world, a world where there were no flaws or imperfections. Her eyes were the green of precious emeralds, and her smile, which she offered often and without prompting, was the source of all joy. She bought a multicolored afghan and a smaller light blue sham my Aunt Claire had crocheted, a skill only she among the family's women took a liking to. I was feeling desperate in those last moments of our first encounter. What if she walked away and I never saw her again, never knew her name? I was about to dare to take our conversation outside the strictly transactional when a man came walking up and stood beside her. My heart fell to the ground. My hopes dashed so completely you could almost hear them shatter. But of course, a creature this spectacular would not be alone. I turned my gaze on him, unconcerned if my despair showed on my face, and unable to control it in any event. "This is my brother," she said, gesturing to him. "Charles Blythe, and I'm Charlotte Blythe. My apologies for not introducing myself sooner." Her brother. It helped explain why he too was a striking presence, and quite handsome in a still young way. Bowing slightly in response, I said, "Julius Tide, at your service." Charles extended a hand. We shook. Then he glanced over his shoulder, scanning the thinning crowd. "We must go, Charlotte," he said. "Mother's not feeling well." "Something she ate?" Charlotte interrupted. "Here at the fair? And after we finally got her out of the house. She needs fresh air, Charles." "She's had enough, it seems. Eloise is walking her back to the car. We must meet them." After a moment's reflection, she turned to me and said, "Thank you again, Mr. Tide, and please tell your mother I love the things she makes." "Mother, aunts, and sister," I said. "I'm not always sure which one made what, but I'll let them know how much you like it all. They'll be delighted." "As was I," she said. "To meet you, I mean." It was her turn to put her hand out. I didn't know whether to shake it or kiss it. I opted for a quick squeeze. "I hope to see you again," I said. Her brother stared at me then, aware of my interest in his sister. "As the man of the house, I'm very protective," he said by way of warning. "We don't come here often." Charlotte frowned, clearly annoyed with her brother's abruptness. "Our father passed 2 years ago," she said. "Charles takes his position very seriously, sometimes too seriously." Both our fathers were dead. I doubted hers had suffered with mild but chronic vampirism, and hopefully not from being a dipsomaniac, but it immediately gave us something in common. "Well, I'm here every month," I said, "and our farm isn't hard to find. Ask anyone where the Tides live, they'll direct you." "And why would we be coming to your house?" he asked, as sharply as he'd intended. "Charles, stop," said Charlotte. Then to me, "He wants me to stay a girl forever." "You seem well beyond that," I said, and immediately regretted it. It was too forward. "Thank you again," Charles said, with complete insincerity. I knew if I were to pursue this angel on earth, I would have to win him over, or at least disarm him. He took Charlotte gently by the arm and steered her away. She waved over her shoulder, topping it with a quick smile back at me. My future was set that day. There could be no other, just as there can be only one end to my journey. Our paths are often determined by choices we make at a moment's notice, including small ones that prove to be monumental. I watched Charlotte Blythe walk away, knowing we would meet again if it was all I accomplished in this life. I was always the last to leave the market, sending the others home to prepare for our evening together. I went back to packing up the wares. I hummed as I did it, and kept humming all the way home. Chapter 4. "Julius is in love," Corinne teased. She'd been needling me for 2 weeks, ever since I'd told them about this marvelous woman I'd met at the fair. We had spent that evening together as planned, and I had been unable to contain my excitement, which was based on nothing more than my fantasy of pursuing Charlotte Blythe and succeeding in that pursuit. My mother remained unimpressed. She'd seen me infatuated before, only to have it fizzle out for one reason or another. She remained at the stove making breakfast for the three of us. "I can't very well be in love with someone I've only met once and spoken to on the phone a time or two." "Of course you can," Corinne said. She'd set the table while I squeezed oranges for our glasses. "But does she love you back? That's the question Julius must have an answer to." Damn her, she was right. I'd called the Blythe home a few times, initially using the excuse that I wanted to make sure Charlotte was happy with the Afghan she'd bought. The first time her brother, who apparently did all the phone answering at their home, called his sister right away, telling her I was on the line. The second time he acted as a gatekeeper, which I assumed he considered one of his primary functions in the family. "Surely you're not still wondering if she liked the blanket," he said when I asked to speak to Charlotte. I knew at some point I was going to have to be forthright about my intentions, given he would see through them anyway. Subterfuge is seldom the best approach. "It's an Afghan, not a blanket. And you are correct, Mr. Blythe." "You can call me Charles," he said. "My father was Mr. Blythe." I detected a certain resentment in his tone. Perhaps he'd had to live in his father's shadow. It piqued my interest about the late Daniel Blythe, whose name I knew from some minor snooping. Neither Charles nor Charlotte had told me anything about him. "Charles it is, then," I said. "I cannot hide the fact I'm interested in meeting your sister again, and pretending otherwise would be a mistake." "Yes, it would." A long pause followed, and I'd feared the gate had been shut against me. "Let me get her for you, Julius." "No Mr. Tide for me. We were to be on a first-name basis. It could mean he was open to my intentions, or it could mean he did not take me seriously." "Thank you," I'd said. And a few moments later, Charlotte's voice, that beautiful heaven song, welcomed me to our second conversation over the telephone. We'd spoken twice more since then, and my sister was quite amused by the sight of her besotted brother. "Julius is in love," Corinne repeated giddily. "Stop it," our mother snapped. We both froze, unaccustomed to Audrey Tide expressing her anger toward us. We'd witnessed it aimed at our father many times, and deservedly so, but seldom at us once we grew out of the precocious child stage. "If Julius is in love," Mother continued, "it is a lesson he must learn from, and one that you, Corinne, must allow him to without mockery." "I wasn't mocking him," Corinne protested. "Goading, then," said Mother. "Trying to embarrass him or excite him or whatever you're doing, I don't like it." That had been the end of that, and we went on to have our breakfast with no more talk of my emotional state or of Charlotte Blythe, although Corinne managed to smirk at me several times and wink, as if I were in on her little game of torture. I ignored her and talked instead about household finances, a subject I knew our mother was keenly interested in. She'd had to be, considering our father's irresponsibility. It even cheered her in some way, and soon my fixation on a young woman miles away faded into the background. I was surprised when Charles called me later that day. Shocked might be a more appropriate word. I'd done the calling. It was not seemly for a woman to call a man or to be seen as the one with initiative. And when Mother answered the phone and said it was for me, I assumed it was something related to the farm. I knew it was not a debtor, since we carried no debt, and it was not likely a friend, since I had none. But I never expected to hear the voice of Charles Blythe on the line when I took the receiver and announced myself. "Julius here," I said, not knowing who to expect, but certainly not Charles. If he'd told my mother who he was, she had not bothered to convey it when she handed me the phone and walked off. "Charles Blythe," he replied. I froze, fearful he was calling to tell me to stay away from Charlotte. What a pleasant surprise. "You've been honest so far," he said. "Don't stop now. I doubt pleasure is your reaction to me calling you unexpectedly." "It's not completely unaccepted," I said, "but it is inevitable." He knew what I was saying. As the head of the Blythe household and protector of his sister and mother, it was unavoidable that we would speak frankly at some point. That point was now. "I called because I know very well you're interested in courting my sister." I braced myself for the rejection I was certain came next. "Her interest is mutual," he said. I caught my breath. "You were right when you said she's no longer a girl. She is a woman, young, but a woman. I won't forbid it, but I will keep a careful eye. That goes without saying. Does it, Julius? Let me say it anyway. I will allow no harm to come to my sister." "I knew you would not. And in that vein, I would like to invite you to dinner here at our home, with Charlotte, myself, and our mother, of course." "Of course," I said, my heart racing. "Any man who invites Charlotte into his life invites us all." "Understood." There was a moment's pause. "I'm not convinced of that yet, and I must be. That's the condition I have. A condition I accept." "Then we'll see you Sunday evening. Do you need the address?" "I know it." "That doesn't surprise me," he said, with just a hint of amusement. "Do you have a car, or shall I pick you up?" "We have two cars, actually," I said. It had been untenable for us to only have one when I had my own errands to run and business to attend to, while Mother and Corinne had theirs. Owning two cars was one of the few signs of our middling wealth. "All right, then," he said. "We'll see you at 6 o'clock. "I'll be there." "Don't disappoint me," he said. "It would only happen once." I felt foolish. I was a warlock. I ran a farm, and I managed an estate with my mother and sister. What could there possibly be about me to disappoint the man, except the things I would never tell him? "I will be there on time." "Yes, you will," he said. "Now goodbye, Julius, and no more phone calls to Charlotte are necessary before then. We'll have plenty to talk about at dinner." He hung up, and I stood there staring at the phone as if I could continue the conversation alone. "Who was that?" I spun around, startled by my sister's voice. She was grinning at me, and I knew she thought I'd just spoken to Charlotte. "Charles Blythe," I said. "I've been invited to dinner." "Of course you have," she said, and she glided away, having enjoyed herself once more at my expense. I had 3 days to think about what awaited me, 3 days to contain myself when the impulse to call Charlotte came over me, which was often. But it also gave me time to prepare myself for what I assumed was a sort of interview. I knew nothing about their mother, but Charles, as a type, was perfectly clear. I knew I had one chance to win him over, and it was a mission I could not afford to fail. Chapter 5. It's a common assumption that everyone knows each other in a small town, but this is not true. I've found it to be more accurate that everyone knows who they want to know. Then they gossip about many they don't know, and remain unaware of the rest. And there are those who choose to be anonymous. My family, for instance, was not unfamiliar to the community, but we kept our lives intentionally obscured from their view. We had secrets that could lead to serious, even violent, trouble. So we had crafted the appearance of a standoffish but harmless farm family living several miles outside of town. It had to be that way, going back many years to when my father and mother met at a celebration of Samhain, familiar to most as Halloween. The difference between what the average person calls Halloween and what witches, warlocks, and various pagans consider Samhain could not be more stark. Halloween is for candy, costumes, and children, or at least it was until it became an excuse for adults to dress up and debauch themselves. But Samhain for us was and remains a holy day. Or, more accurately, a holy night, since it begins on the evening of October 31st. And continues until the evening of November 1st, marking the passing of harvest and the arrival of the dark time. It illustrates that the Tides were not a typical family, and we worked carefully to make sure the only people who knew it were those who were atypical also. So it was unsurprising that I did not know and had not heard of the Blythe family. They lived in town. We lived safely away from it. Their paterfamilias, Daniel Blythe, had managed one of the two banks available to the public. Ours ran a farm, cheated on my mother, and drank whenever a glass of whiskey was within his reach. Add to that my father's aversion to banks, a habit I picked up from him, and it's not unusual I would have had no contact with the senior Blythe. In fact, we spent very little time in the town whose name I may or may not reveal at some point. We had to do business with a financial institution for practical purposes. A farm is a business too. But we had used the other one, and I'd had little reason to interact with the manager on more than rare occasions. It wasn't until I'd met Charlotte and decided we must be together that I researched the Blythes. I made quiet inquiries among the people I interacted with, including several from the farmers' market. That was when I learned that Daniel Blythe had managed a bank, that his wife Evelyn was rumored to have recently developed some kind of illness. Gossip has its purposes. That his son Charles had declined to follow in his father's footsteps and had become a writer, of all things. And that daughter Charlotte was widely considered to be among the most beautiful women in the state of Vermont. I will admit to a certain embarrassment here at not knowing the author, Charles Blythe. I was not an avid reader, and in my defense it turned out that he wrote under a pseudonym for reasons I later learned were quite justified. I had also determined through my investigation where the Blythes lived, and I was impressed. They had one of the larger homes on Hill Street, so named because it was the hilliest street in town. I'd driven past the house twice since Charles offered me a dinner invitation on Thursday. I'd hoped no one inside had noticed the red Chevrolet Bel Air gliding by before turning at the corner. It was the one flashy thing I allowed myself. I told myself I deserved something as the sole remaining warlock in a coven once my father died. As previously mentioned, my uncles were officiates, but neither had any involvement beyond the ceremonial. It was the sort of flaw, the kind of lapse in judgment, that could bring unwanted attention to a man with privacy concerns, but at the time it seemed harmless. As I soon discovered, I had not gone unnoticed. When I arrived for dinner on Sunday, promptly at 5:55 p.m., Charles welcomed me at the front door. He glanced behind me at the Bel Air in the driveway and said, somewhat mischievously, "Your car looks familiar, Julius. Have I seen it before?" "They're common enough," I replied. "It's possible you've seen one like it." "Twice, actually." He smiled, and I began to have a certain appreciation for the man's sense of humor. "May I take your coat?" It was still chilly in the evenings, and I'd worn a long coat for warmth and style. I slipped it off and handed it to him. As he hung it on a rack, I peered down the hallway behind him. "Charlotte will be downstairs shortly," he said, knowing I was looking for the others. "Mother, I'm afraid, will not be joining us. Some kind of illness." "I hope she's okay," I said. "Is it serious?" He hesitated a long moment. "That depends," he said enigmatically. He did not elaborate. "Charles, is that Julius?" I heard her voice before I saw her, and it brought a huge, involuntary smile to my face. Happiness had entered the room, or nearly. I glanced up and saw Charlotte coming down the stairs. She wore a light blue dress that managed to be both casual and elegant, as if anything she wore could not be made elegant simply by her wearing it. She'd encased her legs in flesh-toned stockings, immediately drawing my eyes to them. Perhaps her descent had been staged for me. By coming down the stairs, I had to look up at her and hold my breath, taking in each easy stride as she lightly bounced down the staircase. The silence caused by my gawking became noticeable. "You look lovely," I finally said, hoping I had not stammered. "She means to," said Charles, slightly curt. I got the impression he considered his sister to be flirtatious, and that he wasn't sure how he felt about it. At least that's what I read into his demeanor. "You're very handsome yourself," Charlotte said. Hooking her arm into mine, she added, "Shall we? I'm quite peckish." "That's because you don't eat enough," Charles said. If he'd noticed the entangling of my arm with Charlotte's, he did not say anything. "Let's be seated then. Eloise has been cooking for hours." He'd mentioned the name before when they had left me at the fair to meet his mother, and this Eloise at the car. I'd thought at first she must be a friend or relative, never guessing she worked for them. I should not have been surprised they had a servant, or possibly several. Bank managers were known to be well paid, and I assumed Daniel Blythe had provided for his family in the event of his involuntary absence. Who better to know the perils of being financially unprepared? I also later understood that writing pulp fiction was in fact a lucrative career choice, if one could stomach writing or reading it. The Blythes, I knew very quickly, were more than comfortable. As we approached the dining room, I heard movement, and realized Eloise was there preparing the table for us. "Is she by herself?" I asked, by way of determining the size of the household staff. "Oh yes," said Charlotte. "Eloise is our one and only, literally. She handles everything since Mother became indisposed." It was an odd way of putting it, and I noticed a quick glance between Charles and Charlotte. "Eloise cleans, cooks, looks after Mother, and generally keeps the house running," said Charles. "We'd be lost without her, wouldn't we, Eloise?" We had entered the dining room, and I saw a woman with her back to us as she set a serving dish on a bureau against the far wall. She wore a white outfit common among people in service, neither maid nor cook. She appeared from the back to be older and slightly wide, with the hips of a woman who had birthed a child or two of her own. "You flatter me, Mr. Blythe," the woman said, addressing him formally. I assumed it was comfortable for her. Few in that line of work address their employers by their first names. She finished whatever she was doing and turned around. My jaw tightened slightly. My body clenched. I stared. Eloise, household staff to the Blythes, helper to a matriarch I'd begun to think was bedridden, was not Eloise at all. Or maybe she was, and the name I knew her by was the false one. Standing across the table from us was a woman I knew as Rebecca Savage, wife to Jacob Savage, a local farrier who'd shoed half the horses in the county, mother to several grown children, and the kind of witch we did not want associated with us. She'd been part of the coven for a number of years, but her ambition had unsettled the others. Rebecca, Eloise, was a climber. She'd wanted to control the coven. In fact, she'd wanted my position, or the closest facsimile she could get, and she had not been above turning on anyone who stood in her way. For those reasons, she had been banished. Banishment is always a last recourse, and once done, results in a wariness that doesn't go away. People who are cast out often want vengeance. To my knowledge, Rebecca had not taken any actions against us, but perhaps she'd just been biding her time. Her reaction was more controlled than mine. When she saw me, the only hint of recognition was a slight narrowing of the eyes. "This is Julius Tide," Charles said by way of introduction. Eloise offered me a practiced smile. "I've heard so much about you lately, Mr. Tide." "Lately," I said, smiling back, "and I've heard nothing about you." "I never thought to mention it," Charlotte said, sounding remiss. It wasn't necessary. There had been no reason to discuss a servant. "Well, now you've met, and now we can commence with our dinner," Charles added. "Right away, sir," Eloise said. I knew I would have to think of her as that, or I could let slip her other name. Charles held a chair out for Charlotte, then for me. The table was too large for three people, but we clustered at one end, with Charles at the head. Eloise brought out a soup tureen, set it on the bureau next to the serving dish, and began filling our bowls. Glancing at her from my chair, I suddenly wondered what was going on with this family. A mysteriously ill mother. A single household staff member who was a witch, or had been, and who was there under an assumed name. But why? And was there any connection? Were the Blythes in any danger? I would need to find out as quickly as possible. In the meantime, we had a meal to enjoy and lives to reveal to each other, as much as we were willing. "The soup is delicious," Charles said, having taken his first spoonful. "Thank you, Mr. Blythe," Eloise said, before disappearing through a swinging door back into the kitchen. "She's quite the cook," I said, helping myself to a second spoonful while appearing nonchalant. "How long has she been working for you?"
"Just under 3 months," Charlotte said. "We brought her on after Mother took ill."
Charles shot her a glance, indicating she should consider how much to say. "Our mother became ill suddenly," said Charles. "It's not life-threatening, but, as you can see, it is occasionally debilitating. So we hired Eloise through a recommendation,
With references? I asked, curious that she might work for other families under the same false pretenses. Of course, said Charles. Do you really think we would bring someone into our home without trusting them? I didn't mean to imply that. I'm just not familiar with the process of hiring servants. She came highly praised, Charlotte continued, and she's been a godsend. Mother has actually gotten much better. I attribute it to Eloise's care, what with her teas and herbs and whatnot. Try your soup, Charlotte, said Charles, wanting to change the subject. It's superb. I was suddenly hesitant to keep eating it, what with her teas and herbs and whatnot, but knew I could not refuse. I took another spoonful. It was indeed wonderful. I tasted chicken, with corn and vegetables in a hearty stock. Small beads of pasta floated delicately in the bowl. Most delicious, I said. And most intriguing, the Blythes, their servant, their servant's deceit, all of it. I had found myself in the middle of a complex riddle, possibly several, knowing I would have to find the answers. Chapter 6. I'd had no idea before our dinner that the woman masquerading as Eloise was a consummate cook, perhaps even a chef. The superb chicken soup, which I'd assumed was as good as the meal could be, was just a teaser. The remaining three courses, from salad to dessert, only seemed to compete with one another, with each plate surpassing the one before it. By the time we finished our cherries jubilee, I was stuffed and growing drowsy from the food. I was also much more informed about the Blythe family and their circumstances. Daniel Blythe had died 2 years ago from a brain aneurysm. Such medical catastrophes often come as a complete shock. The elder Blythe had been working in his office at the bank, dictating, Charlotte told me, to his secretary when suddenly he looked at her with great surprise, made a small, incomprehensible exclamation, and fell forward onto his desk. Poor Ruth, Charlotte said, recalling the tragedy. She was so stunned she just sat there waiting to continue her shorthand while our father was face down on his blotter. It took her several seconds to understand he had passed out, so she thought, and to jump up screaming. He had not passed out, obviously, Charles added. He had passed on. There was a sense of cool recollection from them both, which I attributed to the emotional distance time had given them from events, and not any lack of feeling for their father. The mood changed suddenly when Charlotte said, Mother has never been the same. No, she has not, replied Charles. Grief got the best of her, literally. We had just finished our main course of braised rabbit with mushrooms, and I was thinking I could not possibly eat more. Eloise had served each course quietly and efficiently, and managed not to make eye contact with me once the dinner began. Has she seen a specialist? I asked. Perhaps she suffers from some woman's ailment. Pardon my frankness, Charlotte. It's all right, Julius, she replied. That was the first thing we thought of, when her malaise did not lift after an appropriate time. Grief is part of the human experience, Charles said, which I'm sure you're aware of, considering your own father's death. He had clearly done some research of his own, and I began to wonder what else he'd discovered about me and my family. I guessed it was not too much, or I would not be dining in their house. Indeed, I responded. But we had to go on. The farm had to be sustained. My mother and sister had to keep living, as it were. We grieved and got on with it, so to speak. As did Charlotte and I, said Charles. But mother's constitution is not so sturdy. We considered speaking to a psychiatrist, but mother wouldn't have it, added Charlotte. The glance between them came again, as if a subject Charlotte wanted to air should not be broached. Clearly it had been, as Charles shook his head slightly, signaling the matter should be left alone. No need for further explanation, I said, saving us all from discussing or not discussing something Charles did not want to talk about. It appeared Evelyn Blythe had the sort of affliction, emotional or mental, that people still kept hidden despite the progress of the times in which we lived. Two world wars had been won. Modern appliances could be found in every home, yet mental illness continued to be stigmatized. It had not been too long before that when relatives with these types of sicknesses were kept locked in attics. That was when Eloise cleared the plates and brought us the dessert. The conversation lulled while she finished her tasks, and the luscious cherries floating in their sauce convinced me I could eat just a little more. We finished our meal with no awkward moments, other than the brief discussion of their mother. I was as smitten with Charlotte as I'd been since our first encounter, and Charles seemed comfortable enough with me to allow another meeting with his sister. Charles pushed back from the table. "Charlotte, why don't you go spend some time with Mother before we retire for the night?" I could tell Charlotte would have preferred to stay with us, with me. But she, too, was adhering to a strict ritual. Our first time together had been a success, and there was no reason to tempt fate by overextending it. "I'll have a brandy with Julius in the parlor before seeing him out," Charles said.
"That sounds like a good idea,"
Charlotte replied as she got up from the table. "I'll take some Cherry's Jubilee to Mother. She'll like that."
"Right away, ma'am," said Eloise, whose unannounced presence startled me.
She'd been behind us, though for how long I had no idea. Had she been listening to our conversation? To what purpose?
"Thank you, Eloise," Charlotte said, clearly unbothered by the ghostly appearance of their helper. "I'll be with Mother. Please bring it up. And thank you so much for a most enjoyable evening, Julius."
I stood too abruptly, almost knocking over my chair. My heart managed to race and sink at the same time as the object of its desire prepared to leave the room. "I trust there will be a second," I said.
"At least," she replied. "Julius and I can discuss that over a digestive cognac, I suggest, and a cigar if he indulges."
"After an evening this lovely, I shall," I said. Charlotte left us, heading upstairs. Eloise disappeared through the kitchen door.
"Come," said Charles. "Let us enjoy ourselves in the parlor."
I knew he was being politic. He did not simply want the pleasure of some after-dinner conversation with me. He wanted to discuss any designs I may have on his sister. We left the table and headed into the parlor, where I knew my future was about to be determined. You have been listening to I, Warlock, The Warlock Wars, Book 1. You can purchase the book on Amazon in ebook and paperback. Stay tuned for Book 2 in 2024, written by M.A. McNeice.